Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, let me return the words of gratitude to Professor Robert. It's an enormous privilege to be invited to speak here and to join at the fourth colloquium on Iro Glassy, which we have just been provided an extremely clear and concise definition of by Professor Robert, which I will not go over myself. One of the things that he was mentioning in the first leg of his talk in French was that he envisions Sinoglossi as being the interaction between two languages, but not a simple one-on-one reaction, but a more variegated, three-dimensional relationship, which has a hierarchy within it, but is very, very fluid in geopolitical terms, perhaps, and also diachronically as well, across various ages, but areas as well, disciplines within East Asia itself. Today, I want to start our series of eight lectures today, four tomorrow, by trying to provide, think about concretely the context of Sinology in Japan. I'm a specialist on the 19th century in Japan. One thing that has struck me in the last 10 or 15 years is that the notion, the pursuit of Sinological studies in Japan, in art, musical history, literature, and other areas, has become very, very much contextualized with other areas within so-called nativist learning and things that were originally considered to be purely Japanese. Today I want to give a specific example, present you with a specific example of not just Sinological discourse or écriture in the 19th century in Japan being giving a context for the entire frame of culture itself, but also providing a pretext for social interaction and hopefully the very, very concrete example that I'm going to introduce to you today will allow us to think about and to connect and to make these sort of interstices and connections between the various talks that we're going to hear this afternoon, which range across vernacular, social intercourse, orality. I know that two or three of the talks today are going to be centered on recitation, orality, and the sound of Sinological discourse in Japan. What I mean by pretext is that a lot of 19th century culture in Japan becomes gradually closer and closer, approaches Sinological discourse as something that is more popular. The number of people, readers of Sinological texts, increase, the numbers of texts which are published, we know, are increased greatly. And there are genres and various levels of discourse and class structure in Japan, which we basically, when we think of Sinological discourse in the Japanese archipelago, we basically sort of throw out and sort of put a bay and don't consider them as well. But as we move into the 19th century, into the 1820s and the 1830s, towards the disruptions that lead to the major restorations, we see that the framework of something being Sinological or having a Sinological milieu or connotations in a textual context allow people of various classes and of various and who work and produce cultural representation in various genres to become closer to each other and to engage and to produce new sorts of texts themselves. Today I want to focus on a particular document which came into my hand into my hands about a year ago, last summer, when I was looking through some catalogs of an old bookseller in Kyoto, and I noticed that there was an album of scraps, in other words, a scrap album, which had come up, and I called them, and I was able to obtain this album. It's a very, very fascinating album because it contains invitations to art and calligraphy venues in Edo in a period of about 5 years in the 1830s, right when public art and calligraphy venues or salons become very, very popular in Edo. As you may know, these art venues, spontaneous events, which were open to people of all classes and genders and so forth, are something which are particular to Japan, but have as a foundation kanbungaku or kangaku itself. Each of these events themselves is presented as a chance for people to gather and to witness the creation of either a Chinese poem or the writing out in calligraphy of a classical Chinese poem, or perhaps the painting in a sort of bunjin literatus form itself, and to participate in the creation. And the very, very public, I say this advisedly, public appreciation and criticism of the works that are created or displayed at these events. Anyway, this scrap album was kept by a man named Tojo Kinda, whose name is right here. He writes on the cover of his scrap album, in Kanban, obviously, what it is that he's trying to do, and he's saving these ephemera, which usually people throw away, as we today throw away most invitations to parties that we've been to on the next day, but he keeps all of them, so it's a very, very valuable document of the actual human networks in Edo of this period. I've translated, I'd like to read everything in all of the languages that I put up here, but I don't have enough time, so I'm going to only read the English translation. He writes, "Rain began falling on New Year's Day, 1839, and poured on through the fourth without stopping. This prevented me from taking a single step outdoors. Japanese authors, like Chinese authors as well, often give as a pretext for writing a text, when they write a preface, the fact that it was raining outside, and they're not able to actually walk out. They're spending their hours and days in tedium, and encourages them to open up old books and to read and think. And sometimes a demon or a monster will appear if it's late at night. And this is often the sort of the pretext for the beginning of a narrative in many Japanese novels in the 17th century and the 18th century. But this is not a novel. This is actually describing the circumstances under which he created this scrap album. During my welcome reprieve, I decided to dig through some old wicker trunks for paper scraps in order to assemble this album." And he writes this on the seventh day, obviously when the rain has stopped, of the first month of 1838. His name is Tojo Kinda right there, and you can see it's Shoyo Keiroku Satsu. Keiroku are the ribs of a chicken, which are useless, which are not useful at all. So they're things that should be thrown away, but he has an attachment to them. They're things that are not necessarily, but things that he's going to keep, things that have remained beyond a fire that he had. Just to fill you in, the term here that I've translated as flames here is an enormous fire engulfed large parts of Edo precisely 5 years before this in 1834, and his house was burned together with his collection of books. So these are things that he collected from the date of the fire itself, which gives us a very, very convenient way to date all of the things in them. It's set together not as a book. It was originally a book. The cover, perhaps this works. Yes, it does, good. This is the cover that I was just showing you. It's very, very large. And whoever decided to dissect the book, which was one volume, and decorate or turn it into a decorative screen like this, either at the late Edo period in the beginning or in the beginning of the Meiji period, put all of the invitations out here on random. There are two screens, and there are about 62 or 63 invitations to various these parties in Edo at this time. This is what it looks like from the side. This is my office, by the way, if you have a chance to visit us at NIJL. I would be very, very happy to pull this out for you to show you in the next couple of years to go. This is, on the right-hand side, a late portrait of Tojo Kinda. He was a Confucian scholar who lived in Edo up until the first decade of the Meiji Restoration. He was a biographer. The Sentetsu Sōdan Kōhen right here is a collation written in classical Chinese of Japanese thinkers, Confucian thinkers from the 17th century up until the 19th century. And it's a very important source for us when we write about cultural history in the 18th and 19th century in Japan. But he was the fellow who gathered all of the materials for these. He was an antiquarian And was also very interested and involved in contemporary culture in Edo. All of the invitations came to him, so we know that he was the recipient of them. After purchasing this screen, which I just showed you, I went to the Diet Library, the National Diet Library, and found the so-called sister album of it itself, which he collated 4 years later in 1843. So these two albums should actually be together themselves, and you can see that he's written on the cover the same way. On the fourth day of the ninth month, I can't see from this, 1843, I went through my old wicker trunks and selected these scraps of paper to preserve in an album, one good way to pass the time. The day was rainy with strong winds, causing the canal in front of my house to overflow. I actually checked this out. It was raining a lot. This is not just a pretext that he had to write this. I wanted to sort of go into it to show you how a nominally sinological framework or pretexts allows people to create a very, very original, at this point, form to socialize and to promulgate each of their own way of creating art or criticizing art themselves. You can see here it's written Hakkai. It might be written Hokkai, I'm not sure. And it's on the 24th day of the first month. It's an invitation to join the gathering, the first venue of the year. This is one of the pretexts that each of these, as you look and analyze these invitations goes, you see. One of them is the first venue of the year. The Japanese scholars love to do something at the beginning of the year, and that provides a reason to get together for people. And they're usually performed or held at one of the larger restaurants at a scenic point somewhere in Edo, along the river, on top of a hill. The Onoshi restaurant in Yanagibashi was very, very famous because there were geisha houses nearby. Lots of people who were engaged in physical but also emotional labor, so to speak, who could serve at these parties and so forth. Matsumoto Tosai is a Chinese-style calligrapher whose a lot of his work remains today, and he wrote a lot of the texts, for example, prefaces and postfaces for a lot of yomihon by Kyokutei Bakin in this period. So he would gather people together just because it's the beginning of the year, and at that venue would create a lot of his calligraphy for people who had come to ask him specifically to write things, poems that they had chosen, or poems that he'd written himself, or perhaps poems, at this occasion, written by men and women who he was close to. Another pretext for gathering, which existed, which was invented basically in this period, were book launches. New books, when they were published, especially if they were sinographical, would have their own specific art and calligraphy venue, where the author would come and bring his books, give them to people who had already paid to come in, or perhaps sell them there at the event, and at the same time, write many, many poems from the texts themselves, which he would hand out for a small gratuity, obviously, to people who came to them. So it was a way to launch books. For example, Aonuma Chinzan, who's a very important Chinese poet in late Bakumatsu and the early Meiji period, his first poetry album is called Bozan Shu, and it was given its own party at a very, very large restaurant in Edo itself. And these all remain, all of these invitations remain, and they show us how the texts themselves, the way the texts which encapsulate or expand on the Chinese tradition or reiterate classical Chinese poems themselves were actually initially opened up first readers, how they were actually read themselves. One good example is one invitation on the screen. I've translated most of the main part into English here. A small art gathering to celebrate 100 poems on beauties. This 100 poems on beauties, Bijin Shakue, is an anthology of 100 poems which were selected by Suzuki Shoran, who's an Edo period poet, not of his own poems or of poets, poems by his contemporaries, but classical mid or high Tang poetry or Northern Sung poetry themselves, which is illustrated by ukiyo-e artists, which is a very unusual combination in this period for poetry, for Chinese poetry albums. But we can see he has a launching with 30. It's very difficult to parse this just by this, and we don't have very much time, but there are 30 men whose names, whose poetic styles are written under the words Hojo there, who include the major sinological scholars and poets and painters of the period, so that they would get together, coalesce, to support each other, to launch books, which would also turn into an art, a spontaneous, performative art event itself, where all of these poems would also be read aloud or recited. And so forth. This is a copy of our of edition, not a very good edition, which we have at Nigel, just to show you what the book, which was actually distributed on that day, actually looks like. I want to wrap this up because I'm out of time. But another very, very large invitation to one of these art salons is celebrating the publication of a book which is about art salons. This becomes a very, very sort of meta sort of discourse in Edo at this time. Shoga Waisui, I'm going to advance this so that you can see what it is. Shoga Waisui is the title of an illustrated guide to people who are actually active as artists in Edo. Each page, I'm going to move this along, is a sort of sample of the individual artist or poet's work. You can actually look at it. On the right-hand side is his or her name. And then there's a short, a sort of abbreviated criticism of that person's work there. So that if you're from the outside of Edo or you live in Edo and you don't have cultural access to all of this, or access to all of this cultural capital that I'm talking about, you can actually look at the address here. This wonderful personal information is one of this. Look at the address, visit the person, and then ask them to actually create a work like the sample that you've been shown. But the book itself, excuse me, was published commercially. It was very, very successful. I have myself about 6 or 7 copies of it, which were all entirely different editions, which show how many people actually read it. And you can see there's a gloss, an orthographic pun going on in the title. Shoga Waisui, Wai means to collect or to gather, but it also looks like kai, which is the which is what we call these art and poetry venues, shoga kai. So there's a sort of pun going on there as well. And the invitation itself to move back is an enormous illustration of 75 people, men and women, each with their own discreet name written on each of these little cartouches on the inside of it, gathered at the event which is about to occur to celebrate the publication of the Essences of the Art Salon, Shoga Waisui, which is about the writers who are there as well. So there's this very, very sort of circular or spiral-like sort of activity going on, and it's all encased, given as a pretext, this sinological sphere itself. But in fact, it's something which is very, very far away from the ideals of, obviously, of Chinese or Korean or Vietnamese literati themselves. Take a look at these people. It's fascinating. I've actually tried to decipher and to see, actually locate each of these people. And one thing that's fascinating to me is about 27 or 28% of the people who have actual names are women themselves. And this is something that's very, very understudied in Japan. It's underdocumented because most of the documents like this one were created by men. But this is one small window into the actuality of the social interactions of a world which was framed by sinoglossy itself. I'm giving you at the end a very, very short a close-up. There's only one person here in this whole group of 75 people who's standing up, stretching, and it's Mr. Kindai right here. He's standing up. He looks like he's been sitting down for too long. And he's sort of standing up, and you can see there's women around him and men and so forth. And so each of these is very, very personalized themselves, but at the same time public, open to anyone who has one of these invitations or knows that it's going to be on that day. You can almost hear the sounds of people reading aloud, reciting Chinese poetry, which is classical Chinese poetry or more recent Japanese poetry. And it also reminds us of the 17th century or the 18th century portraits in Britain, often studied in the British Academy, of people actually going to see art salons and exhibitions in London, often in Paris as well, and actually people discoursing among themselves about it. And that's often within Western art history and cultural history as well, seen as one of the signatures of the emergence of a public discourse in the West. I would suggest that one channel or one conduit for describing or reevaluating public discourse in Japan before the Meiji Restoration would be these sorts of occasions, which are each given as a context, but also as a bald pretext for their existence, the fact that there's a very, very strong and a very, very broad, broadly accepted and broadly viable commercial basis of sinological culture in Japan at this point. I'm afraid I've overrun my time, but those are the beginning remarks that I want to make, and I look forward to hearing the rest of our talks this afternoon, this morning and this afternoon. Thank you again, Professor Robert.